Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Alonement Podcast, a podcast that celebrates alone time. It doesn't matter if you're single, in a relationship, or somewhere in between. Alonement means valuing that all-important me time. I'm your host, journalist Francesca Spector. Each week, I ask a new guest about the time they spend by themselves and why it matters. My guest this week is author and Love Island star Camilla Thurlow.
Part of it for me has just been learning that alone time doesn't have to be something that I do simply because I don't want to do anything else. Alone time should be a choice that I make because it has good reasons and because it will bring something to my day and to my life, as opposed to cutting myself off from the world because I'm too afraid to interact with it.
Camilla Thurlow is a reality television star, humanitarian worker and author. She is best known for being a contestant on Love Island in 2017, finishing in second place with her partner Jamie Jewett. The pair are still together and are expecting their first child later this year. Before Love Island, Camilla worked as an explosive ordnance disposal expert for British charity The Halo Trust, travelling to the likes of Zimbabwe and Afghanistan to remove landmines and other explosives left over after war. Her first book, Not the Type, is out now, published by Bonnier Books. It's a memoir centred around Camilla's experience of gaining strength through confronting uncomfortable and, in many cases, unlikely scenarios, from bomb disposal to reality television. Camilla, welcome to the Alonement Podcast.
Thank you so much. Very exciting.
I want to start by congratulating you, but honestly, I don't know where to start because you've got so much going on. By the time this podcast comes out, you've had your first book published and you're expecting your first child with Jamie later this year.
Yeah, it's a big year. 2020 is a big year for everyone, I think.
So I've been lucky enough to be catching up on an advance copy of your amazing book. And there was one part that really resonated with me from the perspective, especially of this podcast. You write, somehow I found my way into places where no one expected me to be. And for me, that has made all the difference between what I've done and what I was expected to do. But along the way, I often felt very alone. With that perspective, what does the word alone mean for you today?
That's so interesting. I think, it's tricky because part of me looks back and realizes that the times when I felt alone, I was actually choosing to be alone. Like, I made very distinct decisions along the way to put myself into situations where I almost would be out of place. And so as much as those times were difficult in some ways, I don't necessarily always associate them with being lonely. I associate them more with a time where I perhaps took on a lot on myself or put myself under a lot of pressure But they were also the times where I grew quite a lot as a person. And so maybe I guess that could potentially sound a bit negative, but when I look back, I feel quite strongly that they were quite necessary, those periods of time. And sometimes I did struggle to kind of distinguish between loneliness and being alone. But it's easier, obviously, in hindsight to recognise what, you know, the times where I was around people but felt lonely, and the times where I had expressly chosen to put myself in a position where I would be sometimes judged on my own merits, I guess. Like, I would try to avoid being generalised. And then sometimes just that I wanted to know what my capabilities were, or I didn't want the idea or the fear of being by myself to stop me going into certain areas that I thought maybe would be a good experience for me.
That's interesting. So that makes me think of another part of the book where you say that you have actively looked for discomfort in your life. Obviously, you know, the book itself is called Not the Type. Do you think, you know, discomfort for you was that being outside of that sort of comfort zone for you that you could be in?
I think it definitely spurred me on. And I think I realised quite quickly in my life that actually being in a position of comfort didn't necessarily suit me. In fact, I would feel lonely more quickly within an environment of comfort because I just couldn't seem to engage with it properly. Whereas when there was friction or difficulty or discomfort, it made me feel closer to myself. It gave me a situation where I had to learn more about who I was and what I could do. And it gave me a chance at looking at the future and seeing different versions of myself. Whenever I was kind of following the path that was set out for me, it felt like there was just this one predefined version that I could become. And she felt quite alien to me. She didn't seem like the person that I thought I was. So to think that I was navigating along that path was really scary. Whereas when I was in areas of discomfort or when I didn't know what the future held, there seemed to be a greater chance there that I would end up feeling like myself, even if that meant that along the way it wasn't going to be that much fun sometimes, or there would be mistakes or failures, which of course there were loads of. I still felt closer to who I actually was when I just wasn't in a position which was simple or straightforward.
When you say who you actually are, you know, do you think, are you defining that as that a sort of internal, like a soul thing, or, you know, who is that self and how do you recognize it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't quite know how we do define it, but for me it's that idea that I'm allowed to change or be different in different moments or on different days, and get to know like a fuller version of myself, I guess. And it's very tricky to do that when you're constantly being stereotyped, because you're always having to fulfill an ideal that's already there and already mapped out for you. So I don't necessarily, I mean, I wouldn't even say, for a long time I've said I don't know myself that well, but I think I got a bit confused with knowing myself and knowing what type of person I was. And actually, I do know myself quite well in what things will upset me, anger me, what things I'll find difficult. I just didn't realise that that was part of a multifaceted person and that was okay to be. I thought knowing myself was knowing the stereotypical version of myself. And actually, it's just been coming to realise that I can have a bit more acceptance of these pieces that felt quite broken, but actually they all, you know, they all piece together somehow because that's who I am.
So who is Camilla Thurlow? You know, the alternative example of who you could have been, where would you have been if you'd just followed along in, you know, what your type would have been expected to do?
Yes, that's such a good question. Do you know, I think about this loads now, where I could have ended up. I just think I probably would have followed a pretty straightforward career path. And, you know, I don't really have any comprehension of what exactly that would have been, because it wasn't like there was nothing else that I particularly desperately wanted to do, bar the job that I did end up doing. But had I not had that opportunity, I think I would have just moved into something else and then gone through the kind of stages of the ladder. And, you know, I wonder if maybe I would have felt at this age that I didn't have very much to talk about with regards to myself. And it's not that I do because of what I did, but I just feel like, although it's not seemed like the most traditional path, and there's been lots of people who questioned it along the way, maybe now I look back and think, oh, you know, I wouldn't have been any further along with my life. That was the thing, the idea that kept being sold to me was, oh, why are you going off and doing something different when if you do this, you'll end up in this particular place with a, you know, stable job and I guess like a stable relationship and things. And I don't think those promises are true. I think it's just an idea that kind of traps you in a life that's maybe not, I don't think it's really worthy of people. I think it is that thing where you're sold that two-dimensional view of success. And I just think I wouldn't have been very happy, if I'm honest. I think I would have been outwardly, I would have been maybe successful in a traditional way, but I don't think I would have been very fulfilled.
In your book, you speak about that quite a lot, because you say, and I'm going to quote again because I just adore this book, that, you know, I wanted my life to weave an unruly path through that wild garden, to write my own future as I went. If life was going to be unpredictable and chaotic, then so was I. Your book is titled Not the Type. So, you know, as someone who breaks the mold in so many ways, you weren't the type to work in bomb disposal. You weren't the type to go on Love Island. Is it important for you to motivate other people to do the same?
Yeah, I think what's most important to me is that we have some kind of recognition now that there are these false promises hidden within fulfilling a stereotype or fulfilling an ideal as it's presented to us through various avenues now. But of course, we've mainly got social media, which is showing us almost like a perfect idea of life. And I just think it's really important. Number one, I mean, so when I wrote there that life was chaotic and unpredictable, it totally is. I think we really overestimate our control over life and what we can actually do. And there's so many other things that are going to happen that are going to throw you off course. So you might as well take a bit of agency and choose your own course. Second to that, I think with that kind of forum for comparison that we do have now on social media, it's very easy to start to look at life as if you're making a series of mistakes. That's how I felt for so long, that every time I sort of moved away from what other people thought I should be doing, and then that didn't work out, then they considered what I'd done to be a mistake. Even if it had been years of learning, it was still, I'd chosen a different path and then that path hadn't worked out. And we're constantly being scrutinized now everywhere, but particularly on social media. And so it's just being able to give yourself a bit more freedom that a decision that you make 2 years ago that's not working out for you now is not a mistake or a bad decision. It's part of the learning experience and it's just guiding you on to a new path that's better for you. And we do change so much. Like that was one of the things I found so hard about writing the book, was looking back at this younger version of myself. And sometimes I couldn't understand her decisions. I was like, what were you thinking? We do change, and something that was right for you before won't necessarily be right for you now. So that path, that straight path that you popped yourself on, isn't necessarily going to be the straight path that you imagine. So just, you know, give yourself a chance to make decisions off your own back. And just because a decision then doesn't work out in 2 months, 6 months, a year, it wasn't a mistake. It was just part of the process.
I think that's so important. I think especially, you know, in your late teens, in your 20s, you feel like you're committing to a whole life with, you know, every A-level decision, or, you know, every small, you know, every job that you take, everything seems to define you. And I think knowing that you have that capacity for evolving is very important.
Totally. And it's that thing where you're almost, it's almost drummed into you that you should be afraid of changing your mind. But actually, surely we should be far more afraid of sticking with a decision that's wrong and just blindly following it through, because that's, you know, we're taught to be afraid of standing up and saying, actually, this isn't right, or I think I've got out of this what I can get out of this, or I was just wrong. My younger self didn't know how I was going to feel in 3 years' time, because how can you ever know how you'll feel about things? So, yeah, I think it's important that we try and separate that fear of wrong decision-making from just having the option to learn a bit more about yourself, learn a bit more about the world, change direction.
Do you think there's also, though, a slight irony that obviously, you know, you went on Love Island, you were scouted for Love Island, as you describe in the book, and you came out and you found your partner, Jamie, on Love Island, a show about finding love. You know, that's as much, you know, a straight path as well as any reality TV show could offer.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm not going to say that life won't throw you a few lucky opportunities here and there. Hopefully it will, and hopefully it does for everyone. But equally, I would like to think that I would always look back on that experience, because when I went into Love Island, I had experienced quite a lot of social dislocation. And I went on with the express intent of kind of reconnecting with the people around me and a bit more with myself. And that happened as part of the process of the show. So from the start to the end, and happened because of many of the people that I met on the show. And in particular, my friendships with the other women on the show really played an instrumental part in bringing me out of my shell, in just giving me a few pieces of myself back. And so I think as much as all the outcomes do look incredibly positive, and they were, I still think even if things hadn't panned out as straight and narrow as they have, that I would hope that I would still look back at that experience as a good one. And that's why I think it is so important that we don't disregard the experiences that maybe start out well, but then end up not being quite what we hoped, because that doesn't take anything away from the good things that came out of that. So yes, I do totally understand what you're saying, but I guess it's just trying to look at things that happen in our lives, look at all the different dimensions to it. And I'm incredibly grateful. I'm so lucky that things turned out the way they did. But I was also lucky for a multitude of other reasons that Love Island gave me.
I love that you acknowledge also the power of female friendship, because I think, you know, the 2017 series, especially, that really, really came out. It was a sort of lovely message actually to come from the show. Okay. And I think that, you know, we focus a lot on romantic relationships. So I love that you acknowledge that as a huge part of why that show was ultimately very positive for you.
Yeah, definitely. And that's true for life as well. Like, I am so incredibly lucky with my female friendships, and I'm lucky with all my friendships, but I have a particularly close-knit group of friends, female friends, who have just been there through the ups and the downs, the highs and the lows. And that was one of the things that I found tricky, was when I came back from working abroad, and I felt displaced from that group, because they were my people. They knew me better than anyone. It's that thing where you suddenly feel out of place amongst those who know you best, that can be so tricky, and that can happen for so many different reasons. For me, it was just that when I used to go away, I couldn't bear looking at social media or keeping in touch, because I felt like I was being pushed out of a group. And not, they weren't pushing me out, it was me perceiving that, I don't know, having that worry, I guess, that you're always kind of worried about as people move on and make new friends. I just found it really, really hard. I didn't really know the dynamics of the group anymore. I didn't know who was seeing who, what were the big no-no topics, what were the things to chat about. I just lost my way a bit in terms of how to interact. And so Love Island was kind of maybe a step in what it took for me to feel more comfortable again. But equally, the women who I was surrounded with prior to that and afterwards have remained the same. It's the same group that I'm absolutely best friends with and have seen me go through these highs and lows. And they're the ones who kind of, I think even now, would understand best what I say when I say that sometimes when I want to be alone, it's not to do with, it's not loneliness for me to be alone like that now out of choice, but it was back then when it felt like I was out of place within the group.
That's interesting. And I think it's a really important distinction. I want to come back later because I know that you identify as an introvert. So I want to come back and quiz you about that important alone time. So when you're talking about work, when you worked for the Halo Trust and you were part of a bomb disposal team, you were of course so displaced geographically in that you were all across the world in Zimbabwe and Afghanistan. You were also the only woman on many of your assignments. What did all that feel like from a loneliness perspective?
Yes, such a good question. It's really interesting because being displaced geographically, I found very, very interesting for a number of reasons. I love traveling. I love learning. In some places, I would work with a translator, and I found one of the hardest things was missing those bits of communication that are more kind of conversational. So the comment you might make as your boss leaves the room or something to each other, or, you know, grumbling about something, missing that kind of communication, missing those social moments, I started to realize actually has a really big effect on how integrated you feel within a team. And then when I went to Zimbabwe, actually so many people spoke English. That was the first time I realized how much I'd missed before in the years preceding that when I'd worked in other places, how much I had been missing simply just by not speaking the language. And there was an interesting thing that sort of happened as well, where I started to feel like I tried to make myself kind of, I used to have a Scottish accent, not a strong one, but a bit of one. And when I was working through translators, the Scottish accent isn't the easiest to understand. So I started to really, I started to really take so much care over how I spoke. And you really don't, when you're working in explosive ordnance disposal, you really don't want an instruction to be translated wrong because it's dangerous. You know, that's the main thing. You want what you say to come across exactly how you've said it. And so I took everything out of the words I was saying, anything that could colour it, anything, any kind of emotion, and I made it as factual as possible and as clear as possible. And I tried to say it in a way that was as clear as possible. And I think there was this sort of shift that I began to see in myself where I didn't really feel, when you're communicating like that all the time, I didn't really feel much connection to the words I was saying. And I felt like I was just becoming this malleable person who could go from place to place, which is really advantageous when you're working all over the world. But it's quite strange. Like I felt I was growing distant from my past self, but also wasn't going into a new version of me. I was just becoming an adaptable version. That I think that is one of the key things when you're moving around. It's language barriers and you know, all the kind of social cues that are different. And I wasn't ever good at reading social cues. And I think maybe that's a British thing sometimes, that we kind of expect people to know what we mean without actually communicating it particularly well. So I didn't always find that easy before, but particularly when I was going to new places, it took a lot for me to assimilate the information, to understand what the social dynamic was. It's definitely not one of the areas I was skilled in. And so often I would be afraid that I would get something wrong, and that would mean I'd almost distance myself more, or I would keep myself very closed off. I'd only contribute, or I'd only say something when I knew it was right. I'd only act if I knew it was correct. I just kept myself very tightly kind of condensed down and just did what I knew could be interpreted in the right way. And yeah, so that was over time. That probably isn't a great way of interacting with the world around you, because you're not necessarily having the interactions that really fulfill you as a person who should communicate with other people. There were occasions where it was tricky being a woman. And part of that was because attitudes to women do vary a lot across the world. So you might go from one place where it was right to do one thing and then go to another place, and it would be tricky again to pick up exactly what would be acceptable. And that was tricky because I didn't necessarily have a person that I could turn to who'd been working there previously and ask, what should I do? Because I was working with predominantly male staff. And so just sometimes it felt a bit like, not that you're drowning, but that you're having to find these ways through quite complicated situations without an archetype, without necessarily people around you understanding what you're going through. I think that was the other thing, is sometimes, you know, I'd be told, like you said, I am introverted, so I am quite shy and I am quite sensitive, but I really knew in a professional environment what I was doing most of the time. And sometimes I would be told, oh, you just should be more assertive, or you should be louder. And that didn't actually work for me in many places. You know, sometimes as a woman, it wasn't acceptable to be considered normal for a woman to be within certain conversations or delivering certain information as the leader. And you just have to learn how to interact with people around you and make it work. And that was fine. I was happy to do that. But sometimes if you're told, oh, you just should be louder, or you just should be bossier, that's actually not the right way of doing it. You can find other ways to interact and get the right results, but you just have to learn them. And that wasn't always necessarily easy for the people around me to understand, because they weren't experiencing the same kind of problems, I guess.
Wow, that is a lot. All of that, it just sounds so heartbreakingly lonely on so many different levels as well, from, you know, from a gender perspective, from a almost a loss of identity perspective, having to change your whole accent, and even just the way you speak, you know, speaking in that, as you say, very functional, but that, you know, that way that wasn't necessarily a force for connection, emotional connection with people. Also, I imagine that was a very scary time as well. I can't imagine how anyone would have been working around landmines and not have felt scared on top of all of that.
You have to have, I guess, a healthy level of fear. That's how I always talk about it, in that you must follow procedures correctly. And you've got to be aware that you're working within scenarios where if you do something wrong, there is a risk of injury or death. That's important, because it means that you continue to do everything right, because you've maintained that level of understanding. What's sort of more scary is if people start to lose that sense of fear altogether. So I felt like it was important to maintain a balance. But in all honesty, that was the part of the job that I loved the most, that I got the most fulfillment out of. And when I talk about how I kind of maybe changed my accent, or sometimes I felt very alone in the environments I was in, or that I struggled to find support, I was so I just loved that work so much, like so unconditionally, that that to me was a real, you know, that was fine to give up kind of that other side of things. I was never that sociable anyway. I quite liked this idea that I could be almost like a little worker bee and just do what I was meant to do. And I liked the structure of that. And yeah, I to be honest, I don't, when I think about that time, the thing that always scared me more was getting something wrong within a social setting and annoying the people that I worked with, some of whom I just respected so much or wanted to be like so much, rather than actual fear of any of the work that I was, the practical work I was doing. And, you know, part of it was that it was work that suited me as well. I'm quite good at following rules and regulations and just getting things done. And I found that so satisfying. And you could really see the effects of the work as well. And that was important for me. I feel that that to me for so many years was what I used to fill any other spaces I had inside me. That was what filled me up. And I didn't, you know, I pushed aside a lot of personal relationships because I felt so strongly about what I was doing and I loved it so much. And my real fear was not doing it anymore and or not, you know, not being good at it. And that was why this, that was the only reason the social side ever really became important to me again. It was, I needed to be able to interact so that I could become better and better at what I did.
Wow. You know, I think that's incredible to say, you know, to say you were in that kind of environment where, yes, I think everyone would imagine one scenario, one, you know, one sort of quite narrow view of just being very scared of your day-to-day work. But as you say, it was all, for you, it was all about that competence and, you know, in just achieving so much. And it really, it reminds me of a part of the book where you say that I overachieved in everything bar human connection. And actually, as soon as my life stopped being measured by grades or prizes, I felt lost. Do you think that that came to play again when you sort of were worrying about those human connections when you were away working for the Halo Trust?
For sure. That's you've just hit the nail absolutely on the head. Like before that, I was in these structured environments, you know, you go through school and university, and I would do the things that I knew would get me the results and feedback that looked good, if you know what I mean. I'd do the work to get the grades at university. If there was a project.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
subject that wasn't going to contribute to my overall grade, I didn't do it. But I did really well when it was something that was going to be marked, because that's what I was interested in. It was very formative how I worked my way through life. Then I went into this charity where it wasn't performative at all. You know, the competence level that you needed to have was all to do with getting the right results. But there was no congratulations for that. It wasn't about trying to prove anything to anyone anymore. It just had meaning in itself. And that really it completely changed how things worked for me. So it really suited me in some ways. But then in other ways, I think I was always looking for a way to prove myself to the world around me. And so when I could see that people would look at me and think, oh yeah, she knows what she's doing, but then I wasn't necessarily interacting with them in a way that meant that we kind of had this great personal relationship, I think I started to realize that that was like a gap in my skill set. And it wasn't just a gap that, I think before that I'd assumed that that gap only hampered me. I thought it was only a negative for me. So yes, I wasn't going to be the most sociable or the most popular or the funniest, but I was the one who had to deal with that. It wasn't going to be very pleasant sometimes. I was going to feel a bit lonely sometimes. But actually, how we interact with other people is having an impact upon them as well. You know, there were the people around me that I wanted to be able to kind of, I guess, you want to nurture people in a way, and you want to be able to have a two-way relationship. And my interactions with people were incredibly one way. I tried to do what would people please them. And I tried to do that within the safest framework possible. And in doing so, it just meant every relationship was such like a so top level. It never went deep. So yeah, I think that was probably what I was realizing over the years. But of course, I'm saying that now, like such a benefit of hindsight. At the time, I couldn't quite pinpoint why I just didn't seem to be able to entertain these strong personal connections.
Of course. And okay, so you started working for the Halo Trust when you were 23. Yeah. And you then went on Love Island at the age of 28. So there wasn't much of a gap, really, was there, in between leaving the Halo Trust and started going on Love Island?
There was a little gap, because I went and did a contract with another charity in between. And I had just come back from that contract with the other charity when I received a message that I thought was like a fake message, being like, would you be interested in talking to us about a TV show? So yeah, I think I mentioned that in the book. So there was a little gap, but I had filled that gap by going and working for another charity. Mm. So it was quite an abrupt change of environment.
Yes. Do you think that going on Love Island after that period, do you think that was when you started to be able to have more meaningful human connections that weren't necessarily about being competent at your job or, you know, pleasing other people?
Yeah, I think about this quite a lot. I definitely think it opened up that side of me again. Even going into Love Island, I kind of looked at it as being like almost quite an extreme immersive way of being sociable again, because you just have no choice. You're in a villa for 7 weeks, you don't go anywhere else, and you're around 13 to 15 people all the time. Those people do change a little bit, but you're around them all the time, and there's no TV or books, which are like my normal escape routes to avoiding kind of social interaction. So I knew I was going to have no choice but to do that. So I do think it broke down some of the walls that I had built up. I then think I had to make a really concerted effort to continue on that path, because it is just so easy for me to run away from that side of myself and that side of things. I have a real fear of social interaction, and I definitely, there was a decision I had to make kind of post Love Island that I was going to keep working on that side of myself. And I have been back and forth with it and up and down with it in the last 3 years. And maybe this year I've started to feel a bit like I've made some headway, but that's, you know, that's 3 years of trying to find ways to manage my fearfulness. And I wouldn't even say I'm there. I wouldn't say I'm there now, but I guess that's, you know, it can't be a destination. It's got to be an ongoing kind of project, I suppose.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it's so true. And, you know, when I started this podcast, I actually, funnily enough, I come from the absolute opposite perspective, in that I used to be such an extrovert. I'm still an extrovert, but I used to be such an extrovert that I was terrified of any time alone. So I had to unlearn that. And that's why I created the word alonement, to just have, you know, it's a word for when alone time is valuable and not necessarily happy every minute, but, you know, it's regenerative and it's fulfilling. And why I love speaking to introverts about this is that I'm saying all this and they're sort of nodding along and saying, yes, this came naturally to start with. Which is really, you know, it's such a valuable perspective. And, you know, I've learned so much from introverted behavior as well. So, you know, I want to also say that I think that that can be a really valuable state. And, you know, it's a balancing act. But yes, equally, I think that it's so important for introverts and extroverts to sort of respect that in one another.
Totally. I think the one thing that I know that I did got a bit wrong in that balance is that the reason I was introverted came as a result of fear. And so a lot of the time I would spend on my own, I wasn't that happy. But I was so afraid to push myself out of my comfort zone that it took me either an uncomfortable environment or people to do it. So even now, if I can avoid a social event, there's every chance I'll do it. But I need almost like people in my life who will be like, no, come, you'll definitely have a good time. I have to like be pushed in that way. And then I do. And, you know, I think there's that real difficulty where people know I like alone time and that I embrace it, and I do. But equally, I can be my own worst enemy and give myself way too much alone time and leave myself for far too long in my own head. And so there are people who I have almost like they've had to be the ones to push me out and make sure that I do keep interacting with the world around me. And as much as I'm so grateful to those people, I don't think that that works in the long run. That's when you end up kind of relying on someone to be your source of happiness, or to know what's best for you. And I think it's just so important for me to know what's good for myself as well, to realize I've spent too long being by myself, or to realize that I'm just avoiding an event because I have a fear of the start of it or something, but if I go, I'll be fine. And to have a bit of faith in myself to have these social interactions, because you can't, you know, there's not always necessarily going to be someone there to give you that push in that right direction.
And who are those people at the moment who help bring you out of, well, it's a cliche, but help bring you out of your shell and then sort of push you towards these social scenarios?
Definitely Jamie, because he is really sociable, and like the life and soul of the party. So, you know, that's definitely been good for me. But equally, I don't want to build a dynamic into my relationship where, you know, that he has to kind of be the one who instigates us socializing, or even, it's so nice to have people who support you when you go out, who say, well, you know you're feeling a bit nervous, don't worry, or something. But I want to be able to rely on myself to kind of decompress and to stop myself going to the kind of cycles of fear. So there's many, I mean, some of my best friends, but also my sisters are really, really good at it. And my mum's really good at it. And I'm just very lucky that I do have those people around me. But I know that it can be quite draining to constantly be kind of having to support someone who, you know, I can do this. I've got to believe in myself at some point that I can do this. And some days it's easier to do that than others. And it's always nice to have those people on those days. But I want to be able to be like, yes, I'm introverted, but I know that I can socialize as well. I know that that's not as scary as I'm making it out to be. I know that part of that's constructed in my own head, that all these things that I'm afraid of are things that are often never going to happen. I want to be able to recognize that side of me as being, you know, sometimes helpful and sometimes a hindrance, and be able to confront that when I need to. I think for many years, I mean, that's literally last couple of years that I've sort of come to speak to myself like that. Before that, I would just listen to myself. So if in my head I was going, no, I'm too scared, or, oh, but I'm not going to know what to say, or I'm not going to know anyone there, and who am I going to start a conversation with? Then I'll go, okay, well, just don't go then, give yourself a break. Now, when I start saying those things, I try and talk back to myself and be like, okay, but, you know, you do actually know someone there, or we'll go up and just ask them a question about themselves, and like try and explain back to myself why have I created all these unknown what-if situations already when they haven't happened yet. So I try and be a bit more, I try and be the person that I used to crutch on.
Wow. I think that's so powerful. I think for introverts listening to this as well, I think that's such powerful advice. And as you say, it's a process, and it's amazing that you've sort of taken that more active role, sort of, as you say, speaking to yourself rather than simply just listening to that instinctive fear. Do you find that, so alone time, do you find it sometimes hard to justify in a way that doesn't feel guilty, or are there times when alone time is simply just quality time that you sort of can always justify to yourself?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I think I probably occasionally overdo the alone time, and I do start to feel a little bit guilty about it because I know that I'm sort of pushing it to the limit where it stops being necessarily useful. But then again, the times which I find alone time so important, like I have to have alone time every single day. I guess what I have learned in the last few years, I know it's maybe not literally alone time, but the people who I feel closest to are the ones where we can have alone time together. So sometimes you'll get a message that a friend's coming over and you'll be like, right, I better get the house sorted, and, you know, we'll have to, it'll be chit chat the whole time. And sometimes those situations, they can be the ones that either worry me, or I might feel like I haven't got the energy, I don't know, because I find to be sociable, it takes so much of my energy, because I go through the whole fear process, then I go through the social situation, which still has fear in, and then I do an aftermath where I dissect everything I said and worry about it. But then I have friends who'll text and say they're coming over, and I'll know that we'll probably sit on either end of the sofa and watch a film together and maybe say a couple of words to each other, and then they'll go home. I think part of it for me has just been learning that alone time doesn't have to be something that I do simply because I don't want to do anything else. Alone time should be a choice that I make because it has good reasons and because it will bring something to my day and to my life, as opposed to cutting myself off from the world because I'm too afraid to interact with it. So sometimes I know it's good for me. Sometimes I do feel a bit guilty because I'm doing it for the wrong reasons, which is, yeah.
That's interesting, that distinction, that almost, You know, I live alone and I miss that about living with flatmates. It's that low energy interaction that you described, that you sort of, you know, you can have that companionship but not really, you know, need to make the effort and sort of worry about it.
Yeah, or you can say the wrong thing and you know it doesn't matter. That's like, I mean, one of my biggest problems with social interactions and with talking to people was because I was so afraid of saying the wrong thing for so long, I'd say nothing. And actually, you need to build up that rapport so that the day when you do say the wrong thing, they're like it's a joke, or you don't feel embarrassed, or you think, oh, well, that was just a silly mistake, rather than you being kind of like, oh my gosh, they're going to judge me forever on that one comment, and it was not what I meant, or I said it in the wrong way. You know, it's making a fool of yourself or getting it wrong in front of people is really important to being able to understand that that relationship is strong enough to withstand ups and downs.
It's that almost sibling relationship where you can sort of just laugh at each other, or you know that the stakes are, you know, really low.
yes, exactly.
So what does, if you were to plan a night in by yourself, what would that look like in terms of like the best quality time you could have alone?
That's a really good question. I think on a night that if it was a night that I was using as a night to just let everything go and recuperate, that for me very often means reality TV, because I find it such an easy way to escape into someone else's life. I find it emotional enough that it draws me in because they're real people, but then I find it light enough that it leaves me feeling like I've just had quite a break from my own brain for a few hours. If it's like a precious night, you know, you get them every once in a while, someone's gone out and you're like, I want to make the most of it, quite often then I'll read, because it's not always something you get to do so much. I guess it depends also though whether we have two dogs, so it's whether they're here or not, because when they are here, alone time's slightly different because they are always wanting something, barking at the door or whining. I think I'm so accustomed to alone time that it's kind of rare for me to plan anything special within it. It just, for me, is part of my life. It's something that I can't live without. And I as much value sometimes like the 10 minutes I have to get ready in the morning when the dogs are outside or something, as much as maybe a whole evening on my own. Like, I just have it inbuilt into the day. I just know that I can't keep up interaction at all times.
I love the idea of your dogs always being about wanting attention.
They are the most attention-seeking dogs. And they're even worse now. I think they've got so used to us just being around them constantly, because obviously we've been in the house the last couple of months consistently, that now I'll just go upstairs and they come running after me to see where I've gone. I'm not disappearing anywhere. They're not into alone time. They're not very good at separation at all. I think one of our dogs gets quite bad separation anxiety, so we're very, very careful about that.
Aww.
I know. It's lovely to be loved that much.
No, oh, that's so sweet. I have read about separation anxiety in dogs so much recently, especially with, everyone going back to work and, you know, people are saying, what am I going to do with my dog?
I know. Lots of sad dogs watching their owners walk out the door for the first time in months.
And with motherhood just around the corner for you,
how
do you feel about that in terms of alone time? Because that's going to be a big shift.
So interesting, because I know I'm not that far away now from the end of pregnancy, but I still feel like I'm on a bit of a journey with it all. And I think that's because for me, this, especially the early parts of pregnancy, I just started to see mothers everywhere, but not in that like sort of traditional, you've got to have biological children way. I just started to realize what women who are capable of nurturing are able to do and how strong you have to be. And it was, I mean, it took me pregnancy to realize that, but I don't think that's true of many other women, to be honest. I think most are capable of it. I have a real fear of emotions, and I find emotions very overwhelming, and I'm not good at entertaining a positive and negative emotion side by side. So especially in the early phases where sometimes there's a bit of fear and at the same time there's overwhelming happiness, I just was having to learn how to do that, how to hold these things together. And that is something that I think is true of women's role in society, that they're expected to be able to hold kind of very complicated, difficult, strong emotions at all times. And I started to see it, you know, there were friends who I had who had jobs where they'll just work all night, and even at times where things are really hard and really bad, they just love it. They love, unconditionally love their jobs, love what they do, love their careers, nurture those careers. And I hadn't got it before. I think I sort of thought, well, if something's that hard or making it that difficult for you, how can you still give it 100%? But it's them being able to feel all those different sides of it and still give it everything. And the same with, like, you know, there are people who have just put so much or shown so much joy and happiness to us in terms of our path, even if their own path with motherhood is difficult. And that again takes such immense, I don't know, just this strength to be able to give that to people, to hold on to that, and to embrace all those different sides of what you can feel, and to take the positive and negative emotions and have them together. And it just really reframed. I feel embarrassed in a way, because it did take pregnancy for me to be able to start to feel like that and to learn to feel like that. But you suddenly see it everywhere around you. And I don't think we celebrate enough the role that women take on as nurturers in our society in so many different ways, and how much strength that builds into so many different aspects of life, be that motherhood, be that, you know, the professional environment. And that's been, for me, the last few months, that's been much more the journey that I've been on, the way that I've started to feel this kind of commonality with people around me who aren't necessarily on the same journey or the same path, but just seem to have this thing in them that I didn't realize was there before, because I didn't have it. I mean, that's so terrible, that because I was blind to it or I was fearful of it, I couldn't understand that ability to do that and how much it gives to everyone else. And so I wonder, I don't know what it's going to be like. I never anticipated that would be my pregnancy journey. Not ever. I couldn't have ever realized that. I thought it was going to be completely different, but I'm so glad it was what it was. And I'm so glad that I feel this way about how I see the world around me now. And so, yeah, I think there will be huge transitions to be made in a few months' time, and I don't know what I'll be like, but I don't feel alone on that path. And I don't think, you know, that's quite a nice thought for me. And yes, I know there's going to be some tough times where I probably would like a minute's peace, but that's different. That's like, you know, that's what everyone kind of needs in their day somehow. But I don't feel alone on this journey at all. And I feel like it's opened my eyes up in a way that I just didn't realize that it would at all. Like, I couldn't have possibly anticipated that. And yeah, I'm just so lucky. I feel very, very lucky to have met so many women who are mothers in so many different ways and have brought so much to my life, brings so much to other people's lives. So yeah, I feel, I don't know, it's just totally like, I can't really explain it, because I find it quite emotional, because it's this thing where I feel so sad in a way that all the things that mean that women can do that, kind of this compassion and vulnerability and this desire to be empathetic, have been seen as weaknesses, when the amount of strength it takes just to try and balance those feelings, to be able to do things that way, is almost unbelievable. So that for me has just been a complete revelation, and it, you know, it's taken this year to teach me that, and I'm so grateful that I have learned it, but I'm so much more grateful to all the people who've just been doing it all along, because they're great.
Oh, that is such a beautiful answer. And I love how you speak about having that sense of connection to nurturers on a wider level, not just biological mothers, but, you know, nurturers, women, and all the, you know, all the things that defines being a nurturer, and giving that, you know, that empathy and that kindness and, you know, that sort of selflessness. You know, saying all that, do you now, having experienced that sense of community, do you now feel ready for it yourself?
I don't know if I'll ever, I never feel ready for anything. Do you know what? I never feel ready for anything in my life, but that doesn't mean it's not a good idea to try and do it and to immerse myself in it. And what I do feel confident of now is the fact that I can see how many people are really there to help you. You just have to stop being afraid of that relationship. And it's interesting, because I sort of realized that a lot of the ways I've behaved in the last kind of 10 years are really selfish, and not even being able to, the thing of not being able to entertain extreme emotions was inherently selfish. I was protecting myself constantly, and I'm having to let some of those walls down, because this is the only way I'm going to be able to take on the role of a mother. And that's very scary for me, but because I can see how many people do it so beautifully, do it in so many different ways with so many different dimensions, I feel, you know, I feel inspired by them. And I've always tried to go into realms where I feel inspired by the people. This is just another iteration of that. And it will be very scary, and I don't think I'll ever feel ready. But I don't feel, you know, I feel like I've got so much to learn. I've got so much to learn from so many different people. And I've now finally started to crack some of the barriers that stopped me from learning from others, because I didn't let myself have that commonality with them.
Camilla, I feel so inspired by you and all the humility you show, and, you know, the honesty in the face of all the amazing roles that you've completely aced, you know, being a bomb disposal expert and you coming second on Love Island, and also for me just being one of the most inspiring feminist voices of the last few years, you know. Everyone will know this once they get their hands on your wonderful book, but being an incredible author and writing with such emotion and such openness, and I just know that this new role for you as a mother is going to be so wonderful, and, you know, so
you're
going to learn so much and be able to, you know, pass that information on to so in that way that only you can communicate so well. So thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. So nice to talk about this kind of thing. I absolutely love it, and I love your podcast. Absolutely love it. So it's such a privilege to be on here.
So this is the final episode of season 2 of the Alonement podcast. Recorded during a summer of lockdown and over remote recording software while I myself was isolating alone, I feel so absolutely privileged to have spoken to all my inspiring guests about how they were navigating this strange old time. The question of what it means to be alone, both physically and emotionally, has never been so relevant as now. For me, like many of us, time alone has proved a sanctuary to process the events of the past 6 months. However, it has also been a time that made me appreciate more than ever the power of connection. A huge thank you to my amazing lineup of guests on this series, and to everyone who's been in touch with kind words about the podcast and the alonement concept in general. Finally, I would like to announce, or indeed pre-announce, that I have some very exciting alonement-related news to share with you early next month. I'll be taking a short break from podcasting, but in the meantime, I will always love to hear from you on social media or via email. You can also head over to the alonement.com website and sign up for free to weekly newsletter updates about all things alonement.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.